It gives me great pleasure to introduce our next speaker, Anel Silungwe from Zimbabwe. I'm sorry, I beg your pardon, from Zambia, who is the retired Honorable Chief Justice of Zambia and serves on the Technical Committee of the drafting of the Zambian Constitution. Mr. Silungwe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Fellow participants, I would like to thank the organizers of this conference, and in particular Professor P.H. Kutzen. My paper this afternoon is on human rights and human dignity, and it is divided into 5 segments, namely introduction, women, children, persons living with disability, and the conclusion. Introduction. The dignity of human person, the dignity of the human person is not only a fundamental right in itself, but it also constitutes the basis of fundamental rights in international law. The 1948 Universal Declaration of Human Rights enshrines this principle in its preamble by providing that, and I quote, recognition of the inherent dignity of the human and of the equal and inalienable rights of all members of the human family is the foundation of freedom, justice, and peace in the world, close quotes. For this reason, the dignity of the human person is part of the substance of any right protected by human rights law. According to celebrated scholars, human dignity goes to the heart of human identity. Without dignity, none of the protections of the various legal human rights mechanisms can have real meaning. Hence, the concept has held and continues to hold a central place in the international human rights framework. On December 10, 1948, the General Assembly of the United Nations adopted and proclaimed the United Declaration of Human Rights. Following this historic act, the General Assembly called upon all member countries to publicize the text of the Declaration and to cause it to be disseminated, displayed, read, and expounded principally in schools and other education institutions without distinction based on the political status of countries or territories. Although the rights set forth in the Declaration may not have been realized in all countries of the world today, people everywhere are increasingly demanding and, in a number of cases, gaining respect for their rights and freedoms. The Declaration can be said to be the basis upon which the international community has moved to adopt human rights treaties and relate to specific issues, including the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, and the Convention Against Torture and Other Inhuman and Degrading Treatment of Punishment. I'll now talk about the position of women. There is a United Nations Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. Equality of rights for women is a basic principle in the United Nations. The preamble of the Charter of the United Nations sets as one of the organization's central goals the reaffirmation of faith in fundamental human rights, in the dignity and worth of the human person, in the equal rights of men and women. The International Bureau of Human Rights strengthens and extends this emphasis on the human rights of women. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights proclaims the entitlement of everyone to equality before the law and to the enjoyment of human rights and fundamental freedoms without distinction of any kind, and proceeds to include sex among the grounds of such impermissible distinction. The International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights and the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, both of 1966, which translates the principles of the Declaration into legally binding form, clearly state that the rights set forth are applicable to all persons without distinction of any kind, and again put forth sex as such a ground of impermissible distinction. The Bill of Human Rights, combined with the, the Covenant on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women was adopted by the General Assembly in 1979. Articles 10, 11, and 12 oblige state parties to ensure women's education, work, and health on an equal basis with men. Articles 12 and 16 ensure autonomy, integrity, and choice with a view to enter marriage freely and to decide the number and spacing of children, while Article 6 provides for protection against trafficking and prostitution, among other things. It is submitted that, I'll come to the protocol, to the African Charter on Human and People's Rights, on the rights of women in Africa. At the regional level, the protocol of the African Charter on Human and People's Rights, on the rights of women in Africa, better known as the Maputo Protocol, guarantees comprehensive rights to women, including the right to take part in the political process, to social and political equality with men, to the control of their reproductive health, and an end to female genital mutilation. The protocol is significant in that it reinforces the status of women's rights that have been established and elaborated in other international and regional instruments. It was the first instrument in international law to explicitly enshrine women's sexual reproductive rights. It was also the first instrument in international law to call for the prohibition of female genital mutilation. Notwithstanding the United Nations regional and domestic legal framework, women continue to be subjected to some forms of indignity. For example, the right to equal opportunities with men with reference to civil and political rights is yet to be fully realized in many African countries. We continue to experience an imbalance even in parliamentary representation of women. The recently announced cabinet ministerial and deputy ministerial appointments by President Zuma of South Africa bear testimony of the imbalance aforesaid. The Liberian experience and the Malawian and that of Malawi, where we have female presidents, are equally bad news in this regard. It would appear that the late Margaret Thatcher, as Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, set a poor example in this connection. Surely, it is in the interest of the common good in Africa to observe the need to accord equal opportunities to women, not only with regard to senior positions in national governance, but also in parliamentary representation, in women's parliamentary representation, and other spheres of human activity. Another aspect negatively impacting upon women in Africa is the scourge of gender-based violence. This is a serious indictment against men, as an overwhelming majority of such cases are perpetrated by men. One married man in a country to remain anonymous in Africa was charged with gender-based violence against his spouse. He then claimed, jokingly, I suppose, that some chastising of his wife was a manifestation of love, of the love that he had for her. His wife later withdrew the court case. This brings me to the position of children. We do have the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child. The convention's objective is to protect children from discrimination, neglect, and abuse. It is the principal children's treaty covering a full range of civil, political, economic, and social and cultural rights. It grants rights for children in peacetime as well as during armed conflict and provides for the implementation of those rights. The convention serves as both a rallying point and a useful tool for civil society and individual people working to protect and promote children's rights. The key provisions of the convention is the first legally binding international treaty to give universally recognized norms and standards for the protection and promotion of children's rights in a single text. It is the most rapidly and widely ratified international human rights treaty in the world. This unprecedented wide participation clearly shows a common political will to improve the situation of children. The convention highlights the spirit of complementarity and the interdependence of human rights by combining civil and political rights with economic, social, and cultural rights. It calls for a holistic approach in analysis and recognizes that enjoyment of one right cannot be separated from the enjoyment of others. It creates a new vision of the child, combining provisions aimed at protecting the child through positive action by the child's country, parents, and the relevant institutions, with provisions that recognize that the child has border of participatory rights and freedoms. The convention rests on the foundation of four general principles that express its philosophy and offer guidance to national programs for putting that philosophy into effect. Key provisions focus on non-discrimination, best interests of the child, right to life, survival and development, views of the child, African Charter on the Rights and Welfare of the Children, of the child. The African Charter on the Rights and Welfare of the Child was adopted by the Organization of African Unity, which later became African Union. Like the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child, the Children's Charter is a comprehensive instrument that sets out rights and defines universal principles and norms for the status of children. I'll skip quite a lot of things. There are provisions there that challenge the traditional African views, which often conflict with children's rights, such as child marriage, parental rights, and obligations towards their children and children born out of wedlock. Expressed the saying that the children's charter is higher than any custom, tradition, cultural or religious practice that doesn't fit with the rights, duties and obligations in the charter. The child's charter has a clearer definition of the child as a person aged under 18 years old. There's prohibition of marriages involving children, prohibition of the use of children as beggars, and granting girls and the right to return to school after pregnancy, promoting affirmative action in girls. I'll skip the rest and move on to the rights of persons with disabilities. Rights of persons with disabilities, the United Nations Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities is an international human rights treaty intended to protect the rights and dignity of persons with disability. Parties to the convention are required to promote, protect, and ensure the full enjoyment of human rights by persons living with disabilities. Employment. An estimated 386 million of the world working age people are disabled, according to the International Labour Organization. Unemployment among the disabled is as high as 80% in some countries. The rights enumerated in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights of the World would not be enough. There are also domestic actions taken to improve the welfare of the children. States are obligated to introduce measures that promote the human rights of persons with disabilities without discrimination. These measures include anti-discrimination legislation, elimination of practices that discriminate against persons with disabilities, and other measures, which include making services, goods, and facilities accessible to persons living with disabilities. Persons with disabilities, properly empowered, can contribute their skills and talents like any other person. A 2003 survey in the United States found that almost three quarters of employers reported that employees with disabilities did not require any special accommodation, and that they executed their responsibilities efficiently, just as anyone else who was not disabled. Let me conclude by saying this. It is in public domain that children, persons living with disability, and women generally fall within the category of vulnerable persons who, like anyone else, are entitled to the enjoyment of the right to human dignity. Notwithstanding the right, however, it's not uncommon for such persons to suffer or be exposed to indignity, principally or wholly occasioned by the state of their vulnerability. For instance, some orphan children or those from poor, dysfunctional or broken families end up living on streets or may find themselves in circumstances of degradation. In a similar vein, persons with disability warlock in demeaning conditions. In addition, most countries in Africa lack suitable infrastructure to cater for such persons. Consequently, access to many public buildings, including medical and educational facilities, is a challenge to some persons living with disabilities. Strikingly, even the United Nations or regional instruments bearing on human rights and dignity are ratified, international law does not automatically apply to many African countries, as such instruments require domestication. In this regard, the affected countries need to take necessary measures to ensure domestication of such international instruments. In an effort to promote the right to human dignity, it is incumbent upon African countries to take such measures as will enhance the welfare of their inhabitants in general and those of vulnerable persons vulnerable persons in particular. I have received some measure of harassment from the chair, and I have no right of appeal, and so I must conclude my paper. Thank you very much for listening to me.
Thank you very much for your presentation, and I was very encouraged to hear how much legislation Zambia is incorporated around human rights. But I know that there's a big difference between legislation on paper and realities on the ground, particularly in Zambia. I wondered if you could comment on your experience in terms of the role that religious institutions have played, whether they've been, in terms of your experience, a help or a hindrance in realizing these human rights that are in all of this legislation, making them a reality on the ground, because there's a strong Christian majority population.
The answer to that is that they have not fared well. Religious institutions have fared like everyone else. And so there is no there is no realization on the part of Christian institutions to observe these rights, because they behave like everyone else, which I believe is unfortunate. They are supposed to lay a very good example so that others can follow. Perhaps you can start yourself in your own area and see how far you can go.
Thank you, the Honorable Chief Justice. Coming from Zambia, I'm a clergy now. I want to ask the same question, which may be parallel to some other countries. How do you help, especially the church in particular, to be more proactive in promoting these same rights? Coming from Zambia, I see the church is very inactive.
Well, thank you very much, Dean. I have been privileged to hold senior positions in my church and church organizations. I have been preaching to them. I've been preaching to them the need for them to improve the well-being of the welfare of women, children, and persons living with disabilities. Some religious institutions have been able to take on people living with disabilities. They employ them as deaf people or in whatever capacity, and they are performing quite well. We have not received any bad comments from any of those people. The institutions cooperate. I interact quite often with them, and many of them are doing a fairly good job. In my church, for instance, we do have a lot of women who are now holding positions as clergy persons. Previously, it was wholly dominated by men. And other organizations, including the Anglican Church, for instance, and other Christian organizations that I know of, have been doing this, and they seem to be doing quite well.
My question is again about the activities on the ground. On the ground.
Yes.
Yes, I hope I'm right to address because Jack Silope. Zambia being a Christian country since its independence.
Since
1964.
1996.
Yes. Okay. The unlike South Africa, which remained Christian, even though it created the outlets, of states, they had the free agenda to change religious belief, systems, but they maintained, Christianity as the sole constituted religion. On the ground, how does the constitution of Zambia consolidate other processes of interreligious needs? Because some sources on the ground coming from non-Christian groups, raise concern that their component is not pronounced in the constitution.
Corporal punishment. What is it?
I'm saying the other religious, are not pronounced on the Zambian constitution.
Yes. Zambia was declared as a Christian nation by a person called President Chiluba. Now, in my view, that declaration did not come from his heart. It had political connotations. He hoped that he would influence all religious organizations to render support to his political career. Unfortunately, he turned out to be not a too committed Christian, because eventually he was charged with the corruption, and a court in England found him liable in that respect. And they were trying to pursue the matter in Zambia. They are still trying to pursue it, but how far they will do it, I don't know, because the man has since died. The provision appears in the preamble, and therefore it's not really enforceable. And what it does is that it doesn't discriminate against any other religion. All religious entities have as much right to operate in Zambia as the Christians themselves. When we were drafting the new constitution, which we finished at the end of December, we went around the country. The views of the people were that we should retain this provision. And so we didn't have any way out, because our views was not to depart from what the people had wanted. We have had four constitutional review commissions, all of which had recommended the inclusion of this clause, Zambia as a Christian nation. And so we left it at that. When we had the national convention, it was hotly debated, but eventually they agreed by majority that this should be retained. But even in the draft constitution, we made sure that there was no discrimination whatsoever against any other religions.
Thank you, Chief Justice.
Thank you very much.
There being no further questions for both speakers, And for this dear session to end, and thank both speakers, Professor van der Vever, for your careful and thoughtful documentation of our legal trajectory in recognizing what Belinda Pozzoli would call the patchwork quilt of marriage legal systems in our country, and to the Chief Justice for sharing with us the Zambian experience of your endeavors in finding the common good for women, children, and disabled persons. Thank you.
Thank you, Davina. Ladies and gentlemen, Davina has to leave shortly, and I just want to thank her for standing in for Professor